it's Mountain Edition, all the news from the week here in the Roaring Fork Valley coming at you in the next half hour. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy.
This week, more details were released about the permitting system for Conundrum Hot Springs. Glenwood Springs is looking to fill an open council seat, and I can barely walk on the sidewalks right now, but we're tough here in the Roaring Fork Valley, and it's winter bike to work day tomorrow.
Get out your studs. Also, the Aspen Music Festival and School's summer program is inspired by the City of Lights. The Forest Service has a plan to reduce wildfire risk in the Crystal River Valley, and we'll talk about a new campaign to support Latina mothers if they're experiencing postpartum depression.
The biggest stories from this week coming up on Mountain Edition. So I have to say that I have major Olympics fever. The opening ceremonies, you and I have talked about our weird love for biathlon.
My missed calling.
And definitely the stories of the athletes.
I'm so excited to keep an eye on our six local athletes who will be competing. And I'm really hoping they avoid the norovirus, which is making its way through the Olympic Village.
Well, I'm excited to talk about an Olympic story of yours, Elizabeth, that will actually be on All Things Considered this Sunday for a national audience. So tell us what this story is about.
Well, I'm sure we've all noticed the grass and dirt that are dotting the cross-country ski trails around here. And across the world, race venues are relying more and more on man-made snow to create ski trails. This sets up a tricky situation for athletes who care about environmental issues. A warming climate is undeniably detrimental to the ski industry, but that man-made snow solution is just a band-aid and one that actually aggravates the problem.
And can we get a little sneak peek, or I guess for radio, it would be a sneak listen into what people can hear on All Things Considered?
Sure. It features some local athletes, Simi Hamilton and Noah Hoffman. And here's Hoffman thinking about how his passion for skiing might actually be contributing to climate change.
I don't know how to settle those two sides of the coin in my own mind.
So this is a paradox that a lot of winter sports face, and you can really hear that hesitation in Hoffman's voice. Mm-hmm. We'll definitely listen to All Things Considered Sunday to catch the whole story.
Okay, thanks, Kristen. Moving on to news from this week, campers headed to Conundrum Hot Springs will be able to purchase a permit beginning in mid-April. There are 17 designated campsites available per night, and permits are $10. That's for the entire reservation. The U.S. Forest Service adopted a plan in 2017 to minimize damage to natural resources in the Maroon Bells Snowmass Wilderness. The overnight permit system at Conundrum Hot Springs covers all of Conundrum Creek Valley, from Silver Dollar Pond to Triangle Pass. Campsites can hold between 2 and 6 people, and a permit allows groups to stay up to 3 nights during peak season. There will be a maximum of 68 people camping in the area under the new system. District Ranger Karen Schroyer said in the past there have been as many as 300 campers at the hot springs on popular weekends.
So we're another step closer to reaching some of our goals in protecting this high alpine and fragile ecosystem.
Reservations will be first come, first served. Schroyer says anyone who camps without a permit will be asked to move outside of the area and may face fines. Conundrum Hot Springs is the first area in the Maroon Bells Snowmass Wilderness to require permitting for overnight use.
Catherine Trauger recently resigned from Glenwood Springs City Council. The city is accepting applications to fill her seat.
Wyatt Orm has more.
Trauger has served on the council since April of 2015. She was also serving as mayor pro tem, the mayor on deck, essentially. She's taking a job with Pitkin County and resigned because she didn't think she'd have enough time to do both. The city will be taking applications for Trauger's vacant seat until Monday at the end of the day. So far, 2 applications have been picked up. A new council member must be appointed by March 3rd and will keep the position until April of 2019 when there's an election. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
Leaders in the Colorado Senate are in a position to decide whether to impose some form of punishment against Republican Senator Randy Baumgartner, who represents Garfield County.
But as Benta Berkland reports, the public may never know what consequences he faces.
That's because Capitol rules keep the process secret. Legislative leaders have just now finally confirmed that a complaint exists after our story first broke more than 2 months ago.
This whole problem has been very secretive for many, many years.
Jeff Roberts is with the Colorado Freedom of Information Coalition, which promotes transparency in government.
There's been a perception that not much has ever really happened when the problems do come up.
So here's how we got to this point. A former legislative aide filed a sexual harassment complaint against Senator Baumgardner last November. She told us he grabbed her buttocks multiple times during the 2016 legislative session. The Independent Employers Council investigated the allegations, but under the General Assembly's harassment policy, the accuser must request the documents in the investigation. In this case, a Senate staffer relayed the contents to the accuser and said the evidence suggests there should be a consequence. But who will decide that, and will it ever be made public? That's not known. Republican Senate President Kevin Grantham says he's still deliberating.
We want to maintain integrity, fairness, confidentiality. And at the end of the day, I'm not sure where this will land. We're still in the middle of it. We'd rather have resolution sooner rather than later, though.
When asked specifically if he'd make the final determination public so people would know what happened,
I can't say one way or the other.
And this is a problem for Jeff Roberts.
If people who work in the Capitol do not ever hear about any consequences, especially when the allegations are found to be credible, they think that, well, you know, people just can continue to get away with it. Perhaps people who are victims would be less likely to even come forward.
According to the Capitol's workplace harassment policy, leadership of the respective body can handle disciplinary action, if any. The key is how the term leadership is defined in the GOP-controlled Senate. Grantham could make any decision alone as the presiding member of the chamber, or the majority and minority leaders could also be included.
To allow both sides, essentially the Democrat and the Republican side, to weigh in on that process. That is what is defined as leadership, the top brass, if you will.
That's Democratic Senate Assistant Minority Leader Leroy Garcia. He believes the integrity of the process is critical to maintain the confidence and trust of the public.
Part of what we do here is deliberate and talk and respect each other's opinions and listen to each other. That's a big part of being in the Senate and in the House and representing people's voices. And I would be leery of one singular voice in either chamber saying that they, he or she, believes that that should be the ultimate say.
When asked whether all three would make the decision, Grantham wouldn't say. Many inside the Capitol, including the governor, say there must be teeth in the harassment policy and real consequences when allegations of bad behavior are credible. The state is hiring an HR person and an outside consultant to recommend changes. And lawmakers, aides, interns, and staffers are also attending harassment training. But it's not enough for former intern Megan Creedon.
You could do a million trainings and bring a million people in to try to make it better. But until people start actually being held accountable, no one that actually is going to make those offenses is going to take it very seriously.
Last November, Creedon told us that Senator Baumgardner repeatedly pressured her to drink with him alone in his office in 2016, and that he made an inappropriate sexual comment before a Senate committee hearing. Creedon has not filed a formal complaint, but says she hasn't ruled it out.
So I'm hoping this is kind of, I guess, just a push that everyone needs to take this issue seriously, because it's obviously a very serious issue.
As for Baumgardner, his punishment could range from nothing to more training to being removed from his committee chairmanships, or he could be expelled from the Senate chamber entirely. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
You are listening to Mountain Edition. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. If you're a dedicated Aspen Public Radio listener, you know the kind of local news and programming you can count on every week.
Every week you hear news coverage in Morning Edition, plus local programs like Cross Currents, Valley Roundup, and Mountain Edition that you can't find anywhere else.
Your support makes our coverage of the Roaring Fork Valley possible. In fact, Aspen Public Radio is largely funded by listeners just like you who contribute.
The Many Voices One Valley Pledge Drive is coming up, and your early donations can help shorten the drive.
Please make your tax-deductible contribution now at aspenpublicradio.org or call 920-9000. And thank you for your support. Communities throughout the Roaring Fork Valley will celebrate International Winter Bike to Work Day tomorrow. Commuters in Aspen, Carbondale, and Glenwood Springs can learn more about cycling in winter months and pick up safety tips. Heather McGregor is with CLEAR, Clean Energy Economy for the region. She says improvements in equipment have made winter bike commuting easier than ever.
Colorado's catching on to the fun of winter biking, and we support all forms of transportation that use less carbon. And bicycling and walking is obviously the gold standard.
Local governments from Aspen to Glenwood Springs are working on improving safety and ease for bike commuters.
Elizabeth, you're a winter bike commuter. Do you have safety tips?
I highly recommend getting studs on your tires.
And wearing padding.
And avoiding the West End.
Right. Theater Masters and the Aspen Institute are hosting a panel discussion on theater and politics this weekend.
Claire Woodcock has more.
David Auburn's credits include Proof, for which he won the 2001 Pulitzer Prize for Drama. Abby Van Nostrand is Director of Corporate Communications at Samuel French Incorporated, which is the largest publisher of plays and musicals out there. On Saturday, they will discuss the role of playwrights as voices of the cultural moment. Theater Masters founder Julia Hansen will moderate. The conversation will contemplate the tactics playwrights use to inspire calls to action, the responsibilities of individual artists and institutions in times of national discord, as well as how social media is used as a means of political participation and how theater can help. The program will also feature some of the emerging playwrights whose works are being performed Sunday. The discussion starts at 5 and will take place in the Booz Allen Room of the Koch Building. Theater Masters Take 10 Festival follows Sunday at 7:30 in the Aspen School District's Black Box Theater and will feature 8 10-minute plays from playwrights throughout the country.
For many years, methamphetamine has been the biggest drug on the Western Slope. But opioid use is on the rise. In 2017, the emergency room at Valley View Hospital admitted more patients who tested positive for opioids than meth.
Wyatt Orm brings us this story about the rise of opioids in the Roaring Fork Valley.
On December 28th, the police and EMTs in Carbondale responded to 2 calls within 90 minutes of each other. What happened is still under investigation, but it seems 2 young men overdosed on oxycodone pills, which are painkillers. The man at the first call was already dead when authorities arrived. The second was alive. The EMTs sprayed Narcan up his nose, which is the antidote for opioid overdoses, and rushed him to the hospital where he was treated.
Addicted. Opioids are now the biggest drug epidemic in American history. Every night.
According to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, 115 Americans die each day from opioid overdoses. So has America's opioid crisis made its way here?
I don't know if I would classify it as it's been hit by the opioid crisis.
Carbondale Police Chief Gene Schilling says opioid overdoses have increased.
But I don't think it's increased a lot.
Meth, he thinks, is a different story. His department never saw it a decade ago. Now they come across it 5 or 6 times a year. A spokesperson for the Drug Enforcement Agency in Grand Junction said the same thing via email. Meth is the biggest drug problem on the Western Slope. It comes from Mexico via cities like Los Angeles and Phoenix. But that doesn't make opioids any less scary, says Garfield County Sheriff Lou Valario.
They're more lethal and have a higher potential to kill people than the meth.
Valario is also chair of Trident. It's a drug task force made up of law enforcement agencies from Eagle, Pitkin, and Garfield counties. Opioids can be more lethal because dealers are lacing what they're selling with synthetic opioids that are way, way, way more potent. Things like fentanyl and carfentanil.
I mean, that's an elephant tranquilizer, so you can imagine what it would do to a normal human being.
It's unclear if the 2 men in Carbondale took pills that were cut with something like fentanyl or carfentanil. Nonetheless, this is why the Carbondale police started carrying Narcan in 2015, which is the nasal spray that counteracts opioid overdoses. In 2016 and 2017 combined, Gene Schilling's officers used Narcan 3 times. They refer to them as saves. The EMTs with the Carbondale and Rural Fire Protection District taught the police how to use Narcan. As first responders, they always carry it, and in the past 5 years have a lot of saves under their belts.
We've done it a number of times, quite a number of times.
Very effective.
Very effective.
That's Rob Goodwin and Ron Leach, respectively. Leach is the fire chief, Goodwin the deputy chief. Leach says it's probably once a month they take someone to Valley View Hospital because of an opioid overdose. And he wants one thing to be clear about the people they're transporting.
These victims are addicts, and they're sick. They're not criminals.
and they need treatment.
In the future, more and more people will probably need treatment. Sheriff Ilario thinks it's likely more opioids are coming our way.
I would suspect we're going to see more of it before we see less of it.
His rule of thumb, watch what's happening on the East and West coasts. It all eventually makes its way here. But he says the opioid problem is just that. It's a problem, and one they hope they can solve. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Sebri.
And I'm Kristen Kay. In other Aspen Public Radio news, the author of the 2013 best-selling novel Orphan Train says it can be tough to balance facts with imagination in historical fiction.
We discuss affordable housing in Snowmass Village.
Dr. Temple Grandin was this year's keynote speaker at Garfield County's Ag Expo.
And the Glenwood Springs Historical Society asked Garfield County's commissioners for money to buy gravestones for veterans buried at the Rosebud and Rose Hill cemeteries.
Those stories and more news are on our website now. Take a listen at AspenPublicRadio.org.
The U.S. Forest Service has released a proposal to mitigate wildfire hazards on nearly 300 acres of national forest land in the Crystal River Valley. The plan includes mechanical treatments, like hand-cutting vegetation, at five locations in the valley and using prescribed fire near Marble. The Crystal River Valley is dotted with homes and subdivisions near fire-dependent landscapes. Jim Janung is a fuels specialist with the Forest Service. He says centuries of suppressing fire has meant many areas in the forest are more susceptible to large-scale wildfire. The project is meant to mitigate risks to homes and utilities, including the Nettle Creek Water Treatment Facility. The public can comment on the proposal through March 5th.
A bill that would allow Colorado Parks and Wildlife to raise fees on hunting and fishing licenses was introduced in the state legislature last week. It would also increase state park entrance fees. CPW has cut $40 million from its wildlife budget and defunded 50 positions since 2009 because of budget shortfalls. These cuts have meant deferred maintenance on dams, reductions to programs to prevent invasive species, and fewer grants awarded. The agency is primarily funded by hunting and fishing license sales. The price of those licenses for residents have not increased since 2005. The bill would raise those fees by $8. It would also allow CPW to increase entry fees to state parks by $1 a year for a day pass. The bill has been dubbed the Hunting, Fishing, and Access for Future Generations Act. CPW says it would bring a long-term solution to the funding crisis. A similar bill was introduced last year but died in a Senate committee.
The Aspen Music Festival and School has released details on its 70th summer program.
As Claire Woodcock reports, there will be more than 400 events to choose from.
The theme of this year's summer season is Paris, City of Light. Alan Fletcher is the AMFS president and CEO.
It's fascinating the importance Paris has had over centuries of music making.
The Aspen Opera Center will stage Rossini's The Barber of Seville in July and Offenbach's The Tale of Hoffman in August. This season also marks the 25th anniversary of Harris Concert Hall, which will be commemorated in a concert by violinist and Aspen alumnus Robert McDuffie. The 70th season starts June 28th. Claire Woodcock, Edlis Neeson, Arts and Culture Desk.
Colorado's Department of Public Health and Environment wants to raise awareness about the depression and anxiety that can accompany pregnancy. Last week, they launched a multimedia campaign aimed specifically at Latina mothers. Joining me in the studio to discuss this further is our reporter, Wyatt Orm. Hi, Wyatt.
Hi.
So, Wyatt, what are some of the symptoms that this campaign hopes to bring to light?
Symptoms are things like feeling isolated, worried, losing your appetite, having trouble sleeping. The Department of Public Health and Environment wants women to be aware that these symptoms can occur during and after a pregnancy. So it's not the same thing as postpartum depression. And I also want to distinguish this from what are called the baby blues, which are milder versions of these feelings. They're typically gone within a few weeks. The pregnancy-related depression and anxiety that the state campaign is focused on can be really serious. Here's Dr. Yahaira Johnson-Esparza. She's a clinical psychologist that I spoke with.
In some instances, you are having women who are experiencing thoughts of wanting to hurt themselves or wanting to hurt the baby, kill themselves or the baby.
Okay, so this is pretty serious. How common is it for mothers to feel the kind of depression and anxiety that the campaign targets?
So nationwide, the number is 1 in 7. And they get these numbers from women reporting their own symptoms and also from clinicians reporting their patients are feeling this way. In Colorado, the number is 1 in 10, but the state thinks it's probably more in the 1 in 7 realm. The 1 in 10 number is based only on self-reporting. When women feel this way, there's a lot going on, from hormones to psychological factors. It's complicated even further if there's a history of mental health problems. But women of color experience these symptoms at a much higher rate than women overall. This has to do statistically with things like lower levels of education, lower wages, and less social support.
Okay, so is this part of why Colorado is focusing on Latina women in particular?
Exactly. Something else that Dr. Johnson Esparza told me was that one reason that why Latina women aren't talking about these kinds of feelings is because, being a new mother is supposed to be the greatest thing in the world.
How can you be depressed? How can you be anxious when you just had a baby? There's something maybe shameful for some women to acknowledge that they're feeling depressed and anxious, and they're not feeling that same level of happiness that other women talk about.
Okay, so this is the Colorado Department of Public Health. Can you explain kind of what the public health risk is here?
If parents have mental health problems or mood disorders, their kids are much more likely to have these same problems.
Okay, so how can it be treated?
Dr. Johnson Esparza says you need to take care of yourself. It's back to the self-care. Take a bath, go on a walk, do things that make you feel good. Of course, counseling is an option, and in really severe cases, it might come down to medication.
Okay, thanks, Wyatt.
You're welcome.
Lynn Goldsmith is a conceptual artist best known for her work photographing celebrities. For almost 20 years, she's been a part-time resident in Old Snowmass, and she's had her personal collection of rock photography on display at the Lynn Goldsmith Gallery in Basalt.
Next year, she's packing it all up and heading to Nashville. Claire Woodcock stopped by the gallery and brings us this report.
Lynn Goldsmith was on her way to City Market when she went out on a limb and bought her studio in Basalt's Mid-Valley Design Center.
It had been a high-end tile store, and the lighting, everything was here. So I said, it can be a gallery.
Looking back, Goldsmith calls the decision mentally insane, but insists the space has served her well over the years. She recalls the gallery's second show, where Hunter S. Thompson showed up.
And this place was packed. I mean, this girl took off her clothes. He put her underpants on his head. He burned the underpants. Everyone was saying, oh, my God, this place is back like in the old days of Aspen, you know. And it was a really wild, great party.
The Lynn Goldsmith Gallery features her work and that of her contemporaries she's acquired over time. Many pieces, she says, are hard for her to let go of.
That's George Harrison's album cover for All Things Must Pass. And it's signed by the photographer Barry Feinstein. Barry was a friend of mine, and Barry passed away, so I'm not that motivated to sell it.
There's even pieces she regrets selling at all.
David Bowie and this, like, ferocious dog. And I sold it, and to tell you the truth, I'm sorry, I sold it. I want it back.
But when Goldsmith meets people who she can tell the work means more to them than it does to her,
I'm more apt to let it go. I do enjoy helping others to understand the value of what it is that they're getting.
Next year, Goldsmith has plans to relocate to Nashville. She'll keep the gallery online, but is ready for what she calls a pattern interrupt.
I'm not someone who is desirous of having a career as a gallery owner. I desire to have a career as an artist.
She also says it's easy to feel isolated in Basalt due to the way the town is structured.
I can have much less effort in other places and have more success. It takes more work for me here.
In her move, Goldsmith hopes to expand her artistic palette. Claire Woodcock, Edlis Neeson, Arts and Culture Desk.
The Arts and Culture Desk at Aspen Public Radio is funded by the Stefan Edlis and Gail Neeson Foundation, with a mission to support the arts, community, and outreach.
Last night, Aspen Public Radio hosted the second town hall in a series on housing issues in the Roaring Fork Valley.
Ahead of that, we reached out to residents to learn about their own living experiences, concerns, and hopes for the future of affordable housing.
It's sad that people can't support themselves locally. Or at least even if they are, it's so hard that it almost negates the whole entire purpose of living here.
The fact that it's difficult to find housing in Aspen is a positive. And I've been saying this for 35 years.
Nothing is more relevant and more truly personal
than our affordable housing program, which is housing well over half of our citizens.
And my view on the community is you can't, like, get too close to other people because you don't know how long they're going to be here. Like, they might actually just be here for the next 3 years, and then they're like, well, this is unsustainable. I'm not going to stay.
You grew up here, and you want to stay here, and you went away to college, and you came back with educated, and you work here, and you add to this community. What are you doing to keep these kids in this valley?
There's no lack of appreciation for where I am, and I certainly don't put it in anyone's face to say, hey, look what I've got and you don't have. But I do not want to hear, hey, you've got something I want, and you know what, you're old, you need to move on. And I especially don't want to be told that, hey, maybe you should think of downsizing or moving down.
Every unit that comes up has 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 people showing up to get in.
And my question always is, like, why not build more employee housing? I get it that we love our open space, but at what cost?
All the rules go away as long as the word affordable is attached to it. There's no zoning rules, there's no holdback, there's no density rules. They can do anything they want.
If we don't have a carrying capacity discussion, a bedroom count, we can't solve any of the issues that we want to solve.
All the people I work with have to drive something like an hour and a half just to get to their jobs. And the people that live in these towns also say that they don't want traffic.
Living down valley used to be cheaper before, but now since, like, they know that everyone pays so much here in Aspen, that now the prices are getting higher also, like, down valley.
And then there's some people, like, you know, longtime workers who love it here so much that we're willing to make sacrifices for it, but there is a limit. So if it keeps getting more and more expensive, then yeah, I think I will have a cutoff point at some point here.
We have a 2-year-old and we'd love to expand our family and have one more kid, but we are questioning whether we should do that. We've been bidding for 4 years and we just don't know if it's worthwhile having another kid until we can get something more permanent.
The whole purpose of working a job is to make money. And when you have to create some form of a convoluted government program so that you can create affordable housing for people like teachers, people that are actually literally paid by the government, I mean, why don't you just pay them a living wage where they can afford the housing that's in that area?
Because that's who these people work for, or the local businesses. And are they participating in financing the housing for their employees, or is it my obligation as a retired citizen to pay for their employees' housing?
The reality is I will either get employee housing or I'll move away because there's no other options.
If I gave any advice, it would be that be patient, and if you really want to be here, you probably ultimately can.
That's community members sharing their thoughts on affordable housing. Thanks to everyone who wrote in with questions and experiences, and those who attended the town hall last night at the Belly Up.
That's all for Mountain Edition this week. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. You can find more news from the Roaring Fork Valley and from all around the world on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune into Valley Roundup tomorrow at 3:30. Allison Bechtesh takes a deep dive into the headlines with local reporters and columnists.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.